We are talking today with Larry Everest. He is the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq, and the U.S. Global Agenda. Larry, thanks for spending time with us today.
Hey, great to be with you, Mike.
So start off and tell us why this book.
I wrote the book because I think the world and this country are at a historic turning point, a real moment in history in which literally the future of the planet is being determined. The U.S., under Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and these people, have essentially launched a war on the world, an unbounded war to reshape the destiny of the planet and the people on the planet. And they will call this a war against terrorism. I think it's a war of terror. They'll call it a war of freedom and democracy. I believe, and as I document in my book, this is a war of imperialism and greater empire that's meant to subjugate countries like Iraq, remove any rivals standing in the U.S. path, and essentially lock in U.S. global superiority for decades and decades to come. In other words, they've launched an unending, unbounded war with many, many different objectives that they seek to accomplish to extend U.S. imperial power around the world. And in my book, I focus on how this agenda is being put into effect in launching the war of 2003 on Iraq, in the occupation of Iraq, and in the U.S. use of Iraq as a platform in the region for further taking control of the Middle East and Central Asia and using it as a chess piece in this game of greater empire.
All right. I'm wondering if you can share with us some of the history that you have brought to light in your book, because this didn't just happen, you know, recently. It didn't happen 10 years back. This goes back like 100 years.
Exactly. You know, it was very interesting during the run-up to the war. Bush and Cheney and these people suddenly became Islamic scholars and Middle East historians. They could document Saddam Hussein's crimes going back 5, 10, 15, 20 years. But it was a very funny thing. They never talked about the history of U.S. involvement in the Middle East. And this is something I document in the book, starting in 1920 with the British creation of Iraq and the first oil deals, which involve both British and American petroleum companies taking control of Iraq's oil. I detail the U.S. role in actually bringing Saddam Hussein to power in 1963. I detail Kissinger and Nixon's betrayal of the Kurdish people in 1973, basically encouraging them to rise up against Hussein in order to pressure that regime, and then betraying them at the cost of thousands of lives of the Kurdish people and hundreds of thousands of Kurds driven into exile. And of course, when I was watching Colin Powell and Bush tell us how much they love the Kurdish people, I could only think about that incident. And I just have to tell you, Mike, I gave a program in Berkeley with Daniel Ellsberg, and after the program, a woman stood up in the audience and said that her family was part of this exodus from Kurdistan that was forced by all this manipulation, and she was so appreciative that someone had finally talked about it. She had been carrying this around with her for years, and no one had even known what had happened to families like hers, Iraqi Kurdish families forcibly driven from their country. I document the 1980s when the U.S. government was actually complicit in the crimes that it later used to indict Saddam Hussein. In other words, gassing the Kurds, gassing the Iranians, encouraging Iraq's invasion of Iran. I document the murder of over 500,000 children and other Iraqis, probably closer to 1.5 million through sanctions on Iraq. And let's not forget that those sanctions were carried out under the rubric of disarming Iraq. Well, we find out now there weren't any weapons of mass destruction. So why were those people killed? I mean, there's a whole history here that's been hidden from people. And the main points that I make in tracing this history are three, and I think they're very important to understanding what has happened and what is happening now and what is likely to happen. And the three themes that I felt emerged from that history were, number one, that the U.S. actions in the Middle East and in the Persian Gulf have been guided by considerations of imperialism and empire, not of liberation. Number two, it's inflicted a horrendous toll on the people of the region. You know, the U.S. will rightly claim that so-and-so's a tyrant or certain people are being oppressed and injustices are happening, but the record shows that they don't make it better. They make it worse. They add new forms of oppression. And the final thing, and I think this is very important to understand, is that actions create reactions. Oppression breeds resistance. Events spin out of control. And yes, the U.S. has managed to be the dominant force in the Middle East for 60 years, but there's a potential that it could reap the whirlwind. There's many, many different contradictions that it faces in that region, including rising anger at the United States. And I think this is very much in play today, and what's going to be unfolding in Iraq and the Middle East over the next years.
Yeah, obviously we've seen a significant increase in grassroots resistance to the U.S. occupation of Iraq just in the last couple weeks.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I devote a chapter in the book to the occupation. And my argument is that the resistance is embedded, to use their word, in the nature of the occupation and in the history of Iraq. You've had a long history in Iraq of nationalist resistance to foreign occupation. And we have to be clear, why should we believe Bush and Rumsfeld and these people when they argue that those resisting the U.S. are just terrorists who just hate democracy, who are al-Qaeda, who are Saddam dead-enders? They're spinning the post-war situation just as furiously as they spun the pre-war situation. I mean, after all, they lied about weapons of mass destruction, about ties to al-Qaeda, about September 11th and Saddam's connection to that. Why should anyone believe what they say now? And my argument is that this resistance is embedded in this history of Iraqi nationalism. It's embedded in the anger of Iraqis toward U.S. actions over the years to Iraq. People in this country may not understand what the United States did in the 1980s or the 1990s, but many, many Iraqis do. They suffered it directly. And finally, this resistance is rooted in the brutal and unjust character of the occupation that's now being carried out. George Bush can stand up and say democracy till he's blue in the face. The fact of the matter is that the United States is trying to create a pro-U.S. client state to serve its interests in Iraq and the Middle East. It is not furthering the expression of Iraqi self-determination and Iraqi desires for the future of their country.
And you believe it's more than just oil that the U.S. is trying to secure Iraq for?
I do. But I think oil's an awfully big component of this. And one of my favorite stories on this is that you know, during the run-up to the war, they came up, it was like an excuse for a day. First, it was Saddam was behind anthrax, then he was involved in September 11th, then he was tied to al-Qaeda. Oh, no, forget those don't work. Let's go to weapons of mass destruction. Weapons don't turn up. Now it's democracy. You know, it's hard to keep track of, like the merry-go-round, but one thing they would never mention was the O word, oil. And as a matter of fact, at an October 2002 press conference, Ari Fleischer was asked by one of these embedded journalists, and of course, most of these mainstream journalists were embedded in the government and in the capitalist corporate system here long before they marched into Iraq with the troops. One of these reporters asked Fleischer, "Does this war have anything to do with oil?" And Fleischer, and I go through this in the book, Fleischer at first claimed not to understand what he was even saying. And could you repeat that? What was that question? And the guy repeated it, and Fleischer said, no, it doesn't have anything to do with that. In other words, he didn't even want to use the O word on record. But the fact of the matter is that control of Persian Gulf Petroleum, this is where 60% of the world's oil is, has been a pillar of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East for over 60 years. They spell it out in the 40s when they were first becoming the dominant force in the Middle East in various State Department documents. And ever since then, it has been central. After all, Jimmy Carter in 1980 enunciated the Carter Doctrine that said the U.S. was willing to go to nuclear war to protect its control of Persian Gulf oil. So oil was very much at the center of this war, but it's not at the center in the way most people think it is. It's not so much about Halliburton and Bechtel getting a few billion dollars in contracts. This is chump change to these people. And it's not about Americans driving too many SUVs. Oil is a key instrument of global hegemony. You cannot be the world's dominant power without control of energy. You need it for military. If you have a military that's in 120 countries like the U.S. military is, it has airplanes, tanks, aircraft carriers, all the rest of it that move all around the world, you need massive amounts of petroleum. What did we see in the war that just took place? First, the troops crossed into Iraq, and then the convoys of gasoline trucks followed them to fuel the Humvees and the tanks and so on. So military, it's a key military commodity. Second, the global capitalist economy runs on oil, and any rise in price, fall in supply has immediate impact on the profitability and strategic and competitive position of all these big corporations. A friend of mine, the way he puts it is, oil's too important to be left to the oil companies. In other words, this affects all the major capitalist corporations and financial groups and so on and so forth. I mean, I quote Kissinger in the book saying that Western prosperity was founded in large measure on Middle East oil. And Kenneth Pollack, he was a Clinton advisor. The title of one of his foreign affairs articles is, "It's the Oil, Stupid." And finally, and least understood, if you control oil, and let's not forget Iraq has the second largest oil reserves in the world, if you control the flow of oil, you control those who depend on oil. And the United States has used this weapon in the past with vicious effect, including to cripple the Soviet Union in the 1980s. And the oil weapon is very much at play today in U.S. rivalry with France, with Russia, potentially with China, and so on. So oil is certainly not the only... I don't reduce this war to one thing, to Israel, to oil, to the dollar, or weapons, any of this. I think all of these things are at play. And oil is a very central objective, seizing Iraq's oil and using that as part of this grander agenda that I mentioned earlier of global domination.
Recently, just in the last few days, Bush has been before several press conferences that I don't think he's been quite as polished as his handlers had hoped. And one of the questions, to my surprise, that has come up is asking him about November 2002, planning for the war in Iraq back then. You document multiple pieces in the book as to pre-war plans when they actually came about. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. It's a very interesting point. Paul O'Neill started out the parade of expose. He was the former Bush Treasury Secretary, and he wrote in a book that actually somebody else wrote it, but he was the main source for it, Ron Suskind's book, that Bush was focused on removing Saddam Hussein from power as soon as he took office, before September 11th. O'Neill never saw evidence that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. Then we get Richard Clark, the former anti-terrorism czar, who we all saw on television at the September 11th hearings. Clark argued the same thing as O'Neill. Focus was on Russia China and Iraq before September 11th, not on al-Qaeda, and that the day after September 11th, Bush pulled him aside and said, I want information linking Iraq to Osama bin Laden. In other words, even after September 11th, they immediately turned their attention to Iraq. And now just today, when I was on my way to your studio here, NPR played a press conference. Bob Woodward has written a new book. I think it's called Plan of Attack. He says that in November, it was 2001, actually. This was 2 months after September 11th. George Bush asked Don Rumsfeld to develop plans for the overthrow, military plans for the overthrow of the Saddam Hussein's regime. November 2001, at a time long before his before anyone in his administration publicly acknowledged this is what they were doing, long before they made a big song and dance about going to the United Nations and pretending that they wanted some sort of a diplomatic solution, long before this happened, the U.S. had actually decided to wage war, to invade Iraq, to overthrow Saddam Hussein. And of course, we have Bush, his usual charade. One of the reporters asked him about the Woodward quote, and he claimed to remember a meeting in September where he said the focus is on Afghanistan, and claimed not to remember what he said in November. You know, it's just more lies and deceit and obvious obfuscation. But here's the interesting thing. How do you understand this? In other words, what does it mean that the focus was on Russia, China, and Iraq before September 11th? The focus means that for 10 years following the collapse of the Soviet Union, and you know, we're going through a lot here because so much of this has been hidden from people. So much of the discussion of what's gone on is just, it's like a kindergarten fairy tale for the masses. And the real geopolitical issues are not discussed in the mainstream press. So the focus on Russia, China, and Iraq. For 10 years since the fall of the Soviet Union, strategists of empire like Wolfowitz, Cheney, Rumsfeld, the Project for New American Century, these people, they were elaborating a vision at the center of which was the U.S. determination to be the world's only imperial superpower and not allow any other power to rise to challenge the United States. They had just gone through 30 years of this with the Soviet Union, and the fact that the U.S. faced a nuclear-armed superpower in the Soviet Union tremendously impeded U.S. freedom of action in places like Iraq. This is why they had to play Iraq off against Iran, because they could not go into the Persian Gulf directly without fear of a nuclear conflict happening. So the collapse of the Soviet Union, in their view, provided a great opportunity to enact this new agenda of U.S. unilateral global hegemony, the unipolar moment, the new world order. And this is a doctrine that they elaborated and that Bush actually signed as official policy in September 2002 in a new national security strategy. Again, I document all this in the book. Well, who were the most likely candidates for global rival to the United States? Russia and China. And what country stood right near the southern and western flanks of those countries? Iraq. What country was giving the U.S. trouble and eroding its grip on the Middle East? Iraq. The problem wasn't weapons of mass destruction. They knew Iraq was disarmed. The problem was that Saddam Hussein's continued rule was creating problems for the U.S. hold on the Middle East. Well, you can't control Russia and China. You cannot remain the dominant global power without controlling the Middle East. And that was the connection between Iraq, Russia, and China. That's why the focus was on those countries. Look, Al-Qaeda can hurt people, but Al-Qaeda is a very small group that does not pose a strategic threat to U.S. imperial power around the world. It is being used as an excuse to enact an agenda that has very little to do with September 11th and Al-Qaeda. That is why immediately after September 11th, Bush turned toward Iraq and, you know, waged war on Afghanistan, which is also part of this grand strategic plan they have. This is how you understand this sequence of events, is that the agenda they're pursuing is global hegemony. Iraq is a key prize and stepping stone in that agenda. It has nothing to do with protecting Americans. It is not focused or centered on getting the people responsible for September 11th. Yes, that's one objective. I mean, they want to round up Al-Qaeda, I'm sure, but that is not their strategic focus.
So, as it's become evident, and as you illustrate from the documentation in your book, obviously Iraq has been in their sights for a long time, before this administration even came in. It has for certain people in this administration. Do you have any insight into, then, why they have bumbled their taking of Iraq to such a degree? I mean, the pre-war stuff, the war itself, they were totally didn't put in enough troops. You know, the Pentagon wanted to put in far more troops. And having no post-war plan, they put so much focus on this, and yet they don't seem to have, like, done any of their homework.
Well, you know, I think the way to understand this is actually these errors have flowed from their global strategy. In other words, if you're trying to seize global power on a new and unprecedented scale, as the United States is, these mistakes can flow from it. Here's what I mean. One of the objectives of this new strategy is that you reduce the power of other imperial rivals like France, like Russia, like Germany. China, not an imperialist country, a third world country, but still quite an economic power. This is why the United States could not get UN support for this. This is why the U.S. deliberately would not let these other countries in on the spoils, share the spoils. You see, this is embedded in their very agenda. So this is one thing that's created enormous problems for the United States. One reason that Rumsfeld would not agree to a high level of troops is he sees the role of the U.S. military as rapidly fighting a succession of high-tech wars. I mean, look, they have counterinsurgency operations going on in 80 countries. They've got Syria, they've got Iran, they've got North Korea in their sights. So the decision to send a relatively small force, high-tech warfare with a small number of troops, flowed from that vision and that strategy. And I also think that, as in times past, these people discount the actions of the masses of people around the world. I think they thought that they were going to intimidate and guilt trip everyone with September 11th. How could you stand against this president after the United States was attacked and all this? And people didn't go for that. Millions of people around the world protested. Those protests had an enormous effect on governments all around the world. For example, they prevented the Turkish government from agreeing to a northern front. This had a huge effect on what the U.S. was able to bring to bear in Iraq. And the other thing that they have contempt for is the Iraqi people. And they didn't understand that an occupied people is willing to fight back very heroically, very courageously against overwhelming technical odds. And this is what's going on in Iraq. And as I mention in the book, this is something that you can, if you look at the history of this, U.S. actions have created enormous reactions against them. And the U.S., this is an important point, the U.S. is going into the Middle East in a whole new way. This is a qualitative leap in the level of U.S. intervention. For years, the U.S. could sort of work behind the scenes through Israel or through these various allied governments. Now the United States is on the front lines in the middle of the Middle East, not at a time when the United States has the economic resources to buy everybody off and bring in reconstruction projects and make life better for everybody. There's no Marshall Plan for Iraq. And it's coming in at a time of rising anger against the United States because of the treatment of the Palestinians, the treatment of the Iraqi people, the support for these tyrants. You see, this is an explosive combination.
So are you anticipating a massive backlash on this?
Well, the situation on the ground in Iraq is complicated. There is not a People's Liberation Army, if you will, along the lines of Mao Zedong or even what Ho Chi Minh was leading in Vietnam. It's not like you can say there was a mass sort of organized armed resistance in that sort of a way, but it certainly could emerge, and there are signs that more along those lines is beginning to emerge. So whether, you know, it's possible that the U.S. could temporarily stabilize the situation, but I don't see that as the most likely thing. And definitely over a course of years, this resistance against occupation is going to grow. And one of the things I thought was most chilling about what Bush said the other night at his press conference was, we're determined, I've authorized all necessary force. I mean, they're talking about massacring people. They've killed to avenge the death of four mercenaries, and that's what these people were, whether one liked how they were treated after they were killed or not. These people were mercenaries that didn't have the right to invade a country. I mean, this was an illegal war on the part of the United States. To avenge four mercenaries, they killed 600 Iraqi civilians and wounded thousands and destroyed homes. They're dropping 500-pound bombs on that city. They're using Apache helicopters. Still, they're not crushing the Iraqi resistance, but that's the kind of suffering and mass force that is being brought to bear. And I think, again, Bush let the cat out of the bag. If you understand, if you can decode the language, I like to say there's the Da Vinci Code and the Imperialist Code. If you can decode the language, Bush said, the consequences of failure are unthinkable. And what did he mean? It's true from the standpoint of imperialism. It's true. In other words, failing in Iraq would seriously jeopardize this entire global agenda that they've embarked on, and it would jeopardize one of the pillars of U.S. global power and economic and military strength over the years, control of the Persian Gulf. So this is big.
But it still appears that it's falling apart and that they won't be able to carry through on this.
I think ultimately they won't, but I do think it's important that people understand how serious they are. They do not care what we think about it. This isn't about what the American people want. And the reason that I think it's important to grasp how enormous this is for them is that it helps us understand how violent they will be to achieve their objectives. And I feel that tells us that we need to resist. I'm a journalist and an author, but I'm also an activist. And I think that we have to understand that the protest movement that took place before the war was a wonderful thing that gave heart to people all over the world, that accomplished enormous things. We have to make it broader. We have to make it deeper. We have to make it more determined to stop the killing in Iraq and to force the U.S. to withdraw. And I think that means that we've got to up the level of our resistance. And one of the things I'm supporting is the call by Not In Our Name and many other anti-war groups to bring over 1 million people to New York City on August 29th to September 2nd. That's the date of the Republican National Convention. That's the date the Republicans are going to organize a giant media circus to try to coronate Emperor Bush, to coronate this war against the world under the name of a war on terror. And we have to be in the streets while the whole world is watching, saying no. And this, to me, this gives a vision of the kind of increased resistance that we need. We can't be content with doing the same old thing or just being mad at Bush or just even voting. I mean, the Kerry thing's a whole other question. I don't think he's going to do much different in Iraq anyway. I think we've got to make this look like the 1960s when this whole society is in upheaval, or they are going to unleash this kind of violence and they're going to try to get away with it. I think we have a tremendous responsibility to the people of Iraq and the people of the world to try to halt this.
So doing something on August 29th to September 2nd.
And there's a whole, I'm not one of the not in our name organizers, but you can go to their, you can go to my website, which is Larry Everett, www.larryeverest.com. I've got a link there to Not in Our Name, or you can go to notinourname.net, and they have, there's a full program there of how people can get involved and what people can do. If you go to my website, that's a way you can get my book, Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda, from Common Courage Press. You can contact me. You can see my different articles that I've been writing about the current situation recently. There's some excerpts from the book. It's got my speaking schedule. That's www.larryeverest.com. And you can definitely get to Not in Our Name through that website, too.
So in addition to the Bush press conference that was earlier this week, today he'd had a press conference with, which you mentioned, with Tony Blair, and talking about their relationship with changing some things in Palestine-Israel. How do you see that fitting into this picture of imperialism and hegemony?
I think it fits in quite closely. For years, Israel has been a key U.S. military outpost in the Middle East. I feel the main reason for U.S. support for Israel has been what they call it, their unsinkable aircraft carrier there. The state of Israel has been used to attack neighboring Arab governments, to attack left-wing movements, anti-U.S. movements throughout the region. And strengthening Israel and maintaining Israel's military superiority in the region has been U.S. policy for 30, 40 years. What happened in the last few days is very chilling. The Bush administration changed official U.S. policy. I mean, previously, they may not have said it officially, but they were still supporting Israeli refusal to give Palestinian refugees. We're talking about 3 to 4 million Palestinians whose parents were illegally driven from their historic homeland in the 1940s, refusing to give them the right of return, and also legitimizing the illegal occupation of the West Bank. And Israeli settlements do not constitute some minor part of the West Bank. This is 40% of the West Bank, and these are areas that control the water in the West Bank and key lines of transportation and so on. So effectively what's going on is that the U.S. and Israel are out to prevent the Palestinian people from having any kind of a viable state, any sort of national self-determination. And I think this fits very well into this Bush agenda of greater empire, because one of the objectives of the Bush regime has been to re-solidify the U.S. grip on the Middle East. I devote a chapter to this in the book. They've been running into all sorts of problems in this region. Their allies like Saudi Arabia are increasingly unstable. The Palestinian people keep heroically fighting against overwhelming military odds. This creates ripples of anger throughout the Middle East. It makes it very hot for these pro-U.S. flunky regimes in places like Turkey and Egypt. This war on Iraq and turning Iraq into a platform of U.S. influence in the region, one of the objectives is to try to crush that sort of anti-U.S. resistance and force a realignment and a restructuring of these different regimes in the region. That's what they mean when they talk about democracy and transforming the Middle East. That's what Blair was blathering on about today. But what they're talking about is stabilizing the area or attempting to. Again, I don't think that they're going to get away with this, but they're attempting to do this along the lines of Latin America or Asia to solidify their hold on this area. So I think that's what the connection is, and I think this is a tremendous crime, a historic crime against humanity, what's going on in Palestine. This is essentially a gradual and steady ethnic cleansing and the destruction of a society, which after all had nothing to do with the Holocaust. That was a European invention, not an Arab, a Palestinian invention. So this is essentially the ethnic cleansing of a whole people, step by step by step, orchard by orchard by orchard, home by home by home, wall by wall by wall. And I think that this is horrible. And I think that, again, we not only need to stand with our brothers and sisters in Iraq, but also our brothers and sisters in Palestine.
Re-solidify the Middle East. I mean, has the U.S. ever had it solidified, really? It seems like it's always been, to a degree, moving around, putting out fires.
Well, I think that that's happened, for sure. But I think if you look from 1945 to 1999 or 2000, you can say that the oil, for the most part, was flowing copiously and cheaply through the Middle East, that the U.S.'s allies were by and large in power, and that the U.S. overall had control. Now, you're right. There was always contradictions. There's always resistance struggles. It's never just smooth sailing. But I think that by the late 1990s, they faced a new accumulation of problems in the region, and this is one of the things that they were trying to resolve. Let's just look quickly at the question of Saudi Arabia. The nightmare of the Bush people is that they'll wake up one morning and the House of Saud will be in their limousines rushing for the border because of an Iranian-style revolution, something similar to what happened to the Shah of Iran. The other problem they face is that Saudi Arabia's oil fields have not been able to keep up with global demand. They are not expanding as fast as global demand. There was an article in the New York Times about this. So, what do you do in that situation? Well, one of the purposes of the Iraq War was to get troops out of Saudi Arabia so that the United States wouldn't have to be constantly bombing Iraq and maintaining troops there. Another goal was to force the House of Saud to enact certain reforms and to open up to greater global investment. Globalization at gunpoint. That's how I label it in the book. And so immediately after the war, the Saudis began negotiating natural gas and oil deals with some of the majors. So these are some of the problems and the response. Now, is this all going to work? No. I think it could lead to even greater upheaval. You know, one of the essays that I quote in the book that I want to recommend to people, they can get this online, is an essay by Bob Avakian. He's the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and shortly after September 11th, he wrote an essay basically saying their global agenda is to reorder the whole situation, to reshuffle the whole deck, starting in the strategic areas of Central Asia and the Middle East. And the reason I like it is because reorder the whole situation, reshuffle the whole deck, puts it in a global context and puts it in the context of a very broad agenda, which is exactly what Afghanistan and Iraq are part of. And the other part I like, too, starting in the strategic areas of Iraq, of Central Asia, and the Middle East. Where was the first war in the War on Terror? Afghanistan, Central Asia. Where was the second? Iraq, in the Middle East. What's there? 80% of the world's oil and natural gas are in those regions. And the other thing he talks about in the essay, and people can get this at the Revolutionary Worker online, rwor.org. I also have a link to that at my website, at my LarryEverest.com website. He also says that the actions that the U.S. is undertaking can create a cauldron of contradictions. In other words, they're facing contradictions, their actions create new contradictions, and the potential for this whole thing to unravel is really there. And I think a lot of times that it's very important to understand, because I think a lot of times we feel that, oh, the empire is just overwhelming. There's nothing we can do. These people are all powerful. But they also have tremendous vulnerability as well. They're creating enemies all over the world. And I think that provides the basis for our resistance to really make a difference.
Now, a lot of the history for what's been happening in the Middle East, in Iraq, has been obscured from American citizens by our corporate media here. But that's not necessarily true for the rest of the world, and it certainly wouldn't be true for countries like Russia and France and China, which you had mentioned. So why would a country, let's say, like Russia, not be putting up more resistance to what the U.S. is doing there?
I think that the Russians are. But here's the problem. There's a complicated game going on because Russia, France, Germany, these countries cannot directly confront the United States. My sense is they all have a 10, 20, 30-year strategy for building up their military strength to be able to do that. And in the book, I cite articles saying that these countries were shocked by the war of 2003 and immediately began revamping their military planning. So this is going on. These countries also refused to give the U.S. a rubber stamp through the UN. That's why people like Richard Perle and David Frum say that France is more an enemy than an ally of the United States. I think one part of the strategy of these other countries is to let the U.S. twist in the wind in Iraq and not bring troops in to help, not give them any money to help bail the United States out. Now, at the same time, these countries realize they need Persian Gulf oil. They do not want chaos to spread throughout the Middle East because that immediately affects them. I mean, after all, these are countries bordering the Middle East. You know, there was an interesting article in the Washington Post. I think Jim Hoagland wrote it. He talked of Jacques Chirac's worldview. And he argued, and I think this is probably true, that Jacques Chirac's argument to why he's the head of France, a leader of France, his argument to Washington, D.C. is you need us to control this volatile mix that's emerging in Central Asia and the Middle East. You need us to contend with the rise of China and India. You see, so this is the kind of complicated, and it's very interesting. Zbigniew Brzezinski, who is Carter's national security advisor, and he's been opposing the war. I quote him in the book in my chapter on oil. I devoted a chapter to oil and grand strategy today and how it's playing out today. And Brzezinski's got a new book out called The Choice, Global Leadership or Global Hegemony. And in this book, he argues that the United States, yes, needs to control Central Asia and the Middle East, where 80% of the world's oil and natural gas lies. But this is a tremendous instrument of hegemony. That's what he just says it straight out in the book. But then he says we need Europe to do this. So that's somewhat of the argument among the elites, and I think many of the in the establishment are very concerned that Bush is overextending U.S. forces and has made a mess of things in Iraq, and they're concerned that this could be a long-term threat to U.S. global power, not an advancement of U.S. global power. So this is a big argument amongst the imperialists about how to run the empire that's very illuminating.
All right. Unfortunately, we are running short on time. What final thoughts would you like to leave our listeners with?
We've covered a lot of ground. It's been great to talk. I just would really encourage the listeners to get my book, Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda, from Common Courage Press. I think it can be a tremendous resource in sorting out not only what's going on in Iraq, the history of U.S. intervention in Iraq, but also the enormity of the moment that we're facing today and the enormity of this agenda that Bush and these people are trying to implement around the world, the horror of it all. And you can get the book at your local bookstore, and I encourage people, if it's not, it's in a lot of bookstores, but it's not in every bookstore, and if it's not in your bookstore, I'd really encourage you to ask them to order it. That's a great way to get it more visible. Again, my website, www.larryeverest.com. You can buy the book online. You can read my articles, and there's also contact information. I really encourage people to... Common Courage is a great publisher, but they don't have a great budget, as most of the progressive press does not. So I count on support from average people in terms of spreading the word about my book, volunteering to help me. As a matter of fact, I'm doing 5 speaking events here in the Northwest, and it was all organized by a young volunteer who had never done anything like this before. You know, this is the kind of help that people can provide. You can send notice of my book to your favorite websites or on your email list, tell your friends about it, review it on Amazon. You know, there's a lot of different things that people can do. So again, the website, www.larryeverest.com, the book, Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda, from Common Courage Press.
All right. Well, Larry Everest, thank you for spending time with us today.
Really nice to talk to you, Mike.